We detect, identify, track, and intercept, if necessary, any unidentified traffic within the airspace of Alaska.
A visit to one of the military's remote radar sites in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, where did the idea for a state-owned gas line project come from? Governor Walker says, from the oil companies.
We transitioned the project over to the state, which was the exact words that they used. That took us completely by surprise.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The Missile Defense Agency is bringing some business to Kodiak's missile launch facility. The agency announced today it is awarding a sole source contract to the Alaska Aerospace Corporation that could be worth up to $80.4 million. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, a member of the Armed Services Committee, says the contract will require new construction on Kodiak Island.
Potential housing, sewer, water, you know, because this is going to entail, for the testing, significant number of soldiers coming in on a, you know, not permanently stationed there, but for, you know, a number of months.
Sullivan spoke between flights from the Minneapolis airport. The contract is for an indefinite number of launches at the Pacific Spaceport Complex, Alaska, over the next 6 years. The work would be to test the so-called THAAD system, or Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. It's designed to block short and medium range enemy missiles in their terminal phase as they're zooming down to Earth. It's separate from the mid-course system, which includes interceptors based at Fort Greely. Senator Sullivan says the Missile Defense Agency is expecting to do two test launches of THAAD next year.
There's so much going on in missile defense in Alaska, and so much new spending, and so much kind of relevance in terms of our position in the globe and what we represent. And the threat is only increasing. So I think we're going to see, and we're certainly going to press for it, continued focus on Alaska.
Kodiak Borough Mayor Gerald Friend says more activity at the launch complex helps the island's economy and even boosts tourism.
They do a lot of business with a lot of local people, from shops to contractors to electricians.
The Kodiak spaceport has not had a launch since an Army rocket exploded during a launch in 2014. South Korea is already negotiating with the U.S. to host THAAD missiles. Its defense minister said last week he believes THAAD will counter the threat from North Korea. At the height of the Cold War, the military built secret radar sites all over Alaska. Most of them are still operating, doing essentially the same thing, scanning the sky for anything that's not supposed to be there, especially Russian long-range bombers. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes visited a radar site on the Bering Sea coast to see what the country's front line of air defense looks like from the ground.
The first barrier to getting to the radar site is weather. Low gray clouds keep our planes circling in the air, pilots hoping for an opening after 2 hours of flying from Anchorage to Cape Romanzoff in a small plane. The site is by the mouth of the Yukon River, about 15 miles from Hooper Bay.
Hey, Guzman, how's it going?
Hey, what's up, man?
Driving a pickup truck is Max Jones, the site's radar technician.
This is Cape Romanzoff weather, yes. We have a saying here, come because you have to, stay because the weather won't let you out.
Jones is one of four contractors who work year-round at Romanzoff. Technicians like him maintain these sites, which means doing everything from electrical engineering to plowing the miles of winding road that tie the airstrip to the radar building perched a few thousand feet up. We drive past the two giant domes that house the crew and their heavy equipment, then climb into fog so dense it's hard to see the other truck driving behind us.
I can't see, but are these like sheer?
This is an old volcano. It's 3,200 feet straight down right there.
Jones has been with the contract company Arctech for about 2 years and says it's the best job he's ever had, largely because of the variety of the work. He stays out around 3 months, then goes home to Tennessee for a month at a time.
Being out on a remote side doesn't bother me, but it's not for everybody.
We get out and walk into the most important building at the Cape Romanzoff site, a cluster of low-slung structures built into the rocky ridge with a defunct tram system dangling off the edge. Propped up above is the giant golf ball shield housing the Air Force's long-range radar.
I'm about to enter a restricted area. I'll be your escort. There's no photography inside the restricted area. And the two civilians, I've got to have eye contact with you at all times.
Inside, it looks like a tidy mechanics garage with blocky metal cabinets, industrial fans, and fluorescent lighting. My microphone starts picking up an eerie hum that makes me wonder about radiation. Jones walks us to a back room with a glowing map that shows where the other 14 long-range radars are all beaming pulses 250 miles in every direction, probing for abnormalities in the sky. He hovers near a box called the Radar Signal Data Processor that looks like a large dehumidifier.
Without this, the radar can't do nothing. Everything that the radar creates, transmits, receives, is all fed through this.
If the processor is like the body of a camera, Jones guides us upstairs to see the lens that filters in the rays of light. We crane our necks, peeking at the radar itself.
See that white wagon wheel up there?
Yeah.
You can actually see the bottom of the radar turning.
Jones half jokes that we can't look at it up close while it's on because it'll melt our insides. He spent 20 years in the Navy working on similar radars and knows his way around the equipment. But he doesn't actually decipher the signals. The whole site, all the equipment, the roads, the dome homes, they're all built so that this radar can work like a nerve ending, feeding signals back to a distant brain.
We detect, identify, track, and intercept, if necessary, any unidentified traffic within the airspace of Alaska.
540 miles away, in Anchorage, at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Lieutenant Colonel Kerry Howard oversees the large crew inside a windowless subterranean facility. It's filled with glowing computer monitors and looks basically like the war room in every movie ever made.
So the radars that are around the state, all of those sensors and all that data feeds into our facility to display on our battle control system, and it shows up as dots on a screen and location, and from there we can determine whether they're actual aircraft or not.
Howard says in an average year, the personnel here detect 10 or so Russian military aircraft probing international airspace close to Alaska, which prompts the Air Force to scramble F-22s to escort them elsewhere. The operation is staffed 24/7, and Howard says the Russian planes seem to come the most often on national holidays like the 4th of July.
We're the front lines, I guess you could say, of air defense.
On the wall are hundreds of red stars for each time this has happened since the radar system was built in the early 50s. The information feeds into NORAD's headquarters in Colorado, but all the personnel, the equipment, the signals pulsing overhead, Max Jones says all of it starts with radars quietly spinning atop mountains and old volcanoes.
That's the mission. Everybody else out here, the plane that you came in on, its mission is to support that radar, that thing that goes around above your head.
In Cape Romanzoff, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Tomorrow, we'll hear what it's like to live at a remote radar site with just three other people for months at a time and why people think it's worth it. Governor Bill Walker says the state's three oil company partners told his administration in February they weren't sure they could move ahead with the effort to build a natural gas line and suggested the state take over. Walker's comments came a day after lawmakers grilled his point person on the project, and the companies, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, also expressed skepticism, telling a slightly different story. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rachel Waldholz reports.
In its current form, the state holds a 25% share of the massive Alaska LNG project, partnering with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. But Walker says that in a meeting on February 9th, the company said they weren't sure they'd be able to continue the project next year as planned and offered two options: slow down work or let the state take control.
The words they used is we transition the project over to the state was the exact words that they used. That took us completely by surprise, which was fine. I mean, they certainly have every right to do that.
Walker says the company still wanted to continue negotiations on fiscal certainty. That's jargon for locking in taxes on the project. But he says with the whole structure up in the air, the state didn't see a point in that and broke off negotiations. Companies told a slightly different story to lawmakers on Wednesday. They said they just received the proposal for a state-controlled gas line last week, the same time it was made public to reporters. Walker says that puzzles him.
Not only did they understand it, it was their idea, it was their concept that they brought to us. So I'm a little surprised when now what they could mean is that this is the first time they've seen this specific on-paper proposal as a follow-up to what they had proposed. Perhaps that's what they were saying, but the concept, goodness, it was one that was that they brought to us.
Either way, in testimony on Wednesday, the companies did not seem enthusiastic about a state-run project. All three stressed the key point is whether an Alaska natural gas project can compete in the current global market. In other words, can it be built cheaply enough? And right now, it's clear the companies don't think so. Alaska BP regional manager David Van Tile said he understands the state's desire for a project, especially given Alaska's budget situation.
But we don't want to move quickly at all costs. We don't want to rush into the largest energy project in North America that only ends up losing lots of money for all of us.
Lawmakers also expressed skepticism on Wednesday. They grilled the new head of the state-owned Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, Keith Meyer, for more than 4 hours. Meyer was blunt. The existing partnership may have made sense a year ago, he said, but the market has changed.
I'm not saying that the current path that the project is on is wrong, and nor was it wrong. However, I think we need to recognize that under the current path, this project is not going forward.
Many lawmakers remained unconvinced. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker asked if the state is prepared to take on the increased risk that comes with increased ownership. Soldotna Republican Peter Michicki said he doesn't see why the project needs to move forward immediately, saying, "I don't subscribe to the build it now or die mentality." But it was Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson who touched on the heart of the issue. If the project doesn't work for the big three oil companies, he said, why should it work for the state?
I've sort of felt like if the three majors saw merit in moving forward, the plan had merit. And if they didn't, it likely didn't. Mm-hmm. Is there something you can tell me that would dispel that general concern?
Meyer said essentially the three companies have to weigh the Alaska project against many others in their portfolios. Just because it comes up short for them, he said, doesn't mean it's not worth it for us. But, he said, that's what Alaska has to find out. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Muslims celebrate Ramadan under the midnight sun.
When I fast, I feel really between me and God, like rest with me and God.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The U.S. Forest Service moved forward today with plans to transition to second growth harvest on the Tongass National Forest within 16 years. The draft record of a decision represents a compromise that won't leave anyone completely happy. Some groups complain the transition will happen too quickly, while others say it won't be fast enough. KRBD's Layla Carey has more. Trout Unlimited Alaska likes the decision because it protects more salmon streams, but various conservation groups are unhappy and say that the transition should be faster. On the timber industry side, Owen Graham of the Alaska Forest Association says the transition needs to slow down.
We've always agreed that there needs to be a transition, but we wanted the trees to reach maturity, which is some 30 years in the future. If they cut the trees now over the next 10 to 15 years like they're talking about, then they'll be too small to be profitably sawn in the sawmills, and they'll just end up being exported to China.
Dominic Della Sala, though, says it has worked in his state. He's a scientist with the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, and also is unhappy with the draft record of decision, but his complaint is that the proposed transition is too slow and will not do enough to combat climate change.
And I think the Forest Service is missing an opportunity here because they're basing it on old school forestry and antiquated log processing techniques.
Della Sala, who advocates a transition within 5 years, says there are new technologies that will allow mills to operate profitably with young growth trees. He says Good Faith Lumber on Prince of Wales Island tested that equipment and it worked, which shows mills that are willing to adapt can survive a transition. The Tongass Plan Amendment has been in the works for a few years, ever since Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack directed the Forest Service to transition to young growth. Part of that process was the formation of the Tongass Advisory Committee, or TAC, a group of 15 representatives of Southeast Conservation, Tribal, and Timber Industry groups. Andrew Tomes of the Sitka Conservation Society was one of the TAC members representing environmental interests.
As a conservationist, I'd love to see the Forest Service get out of old growth right now. But our involvement in the advisory committee really followed this ethic of trying to figure out how to come up with a collaborative solution and make Tongass management work for all the stakeholder groups.
Tom says Alternative 5 protects high-value habitat and provides a roadmap for a full transition to young growth. He added that dissatisfaction on the part of some timber industry representatives and some conservation groups indicates that the decision is a true compromise. There has been some concern by Alaska's congressional delegation that the amendment is moving forward before a complete inventory of young growth is complete, and there is pending legislation to delay the transition. But Tongass Forest Supervisor Stewart says that is not an impediment. He says the Forest Service considered hundreds of thousands of comments on the issue, along with attack recommendations and input from scientists.
We believe we have enough information at this time to go forward with the first forest plan amendment, yet concurrently we will continue with the inventory for more on-the-ground project decisions.
And if that inventory shows there is not adequate young growth to support the industry, Stewart says there is flexibility within the Tongass Land Management Plan to evolve. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
In Nome, the search for 36-year-old law clerk Joseph Balderas continues. Other than his abandoned car near mile 44 on the Nome Council Highway, there has been no sign of him. Searchers on foot and ATVs, as well as dog teams, have been out scouring the tundra. The search has been tiring for the members of Nome's search and rescue team. Erica Wheeler spent hours in a spotter helicopter looking for any clues to Balderas' whereabouts. She says she is doing her best to stay positive.
Every time we've refueled or landed and gotten back up in the air, I've had hope that we'd come up with something, and that restarts every single day. I wake up and I have hope that we will be finding him.
Alaska State Trooper John Strobel says these kinds of searches are difficult.
Day one, you know, you're looking so hard because you think you're going to see him, and then each day it probably diminishes a little bit, but we're still continuing in the hopes that he is alive.
Strobel says he admires the dedication of those searching for Balderas.
Kind of reaffirms my faith in humans. I get to see a lot of unfortunate things in my career, and this is inspiring.
Volunteers with Nome Search and Rescue plan to continue their search for Balderas until he is found or officials call off the search.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Muslim holy month of Ramadan is drawing to a close. During Ramadan, Muslims fast from sunup until sundown. Since Islam follows the lunar calendar, the date of the fast changes every year. And this time around, it falls on the longest days of summer in Alaska, when the sun hardly sets. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned about the fast and why, for some local Muslims, that's not the obstacle they worry about.
As soon as the call to prayer begins at the masjid, or mosque, in Anchorage, Fantin Najjar offers me a plate of dates.
What we keep doing, the first things, we keep eating dates, and then we drink water, and we pray.
We chew on our fruit, then head into the small room where the women pray. This evening, Najjar and her daughter and I are alone. They face a TV screen that shows what the religious leader is doing in the men's room. In Islam, men and women pray separately. Then it's time to really eat. The table is filled with large dishes of fish, meats, and rice, many of which Najjar cooked to share. This is a time of joy for her.
When I fast, I feel really between me and God, like rest with me and me and God. I feel what I'm doing now, cooking, I feel happiness with this.
We settle down to eat, but here's the catch. It's only a little after 7 p.m. and the sun is still up. Yosef Barber, one of the masjid's religious leaders, explains that for communities in the far north with extreme daylight hours, Muslim scholars decided it was okay to follow the sunlight clock for Mecca, Islam's holiest city. That means fasting for about 15 hours, not 19.
We like to follow the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in everything he does. So we find ourselves here in Alaska in a place that we know that the Prophet Muhammad had never been in such a place. And so to fast until sunset according to the sunnah, according to the tradition, is really a guess. It's what would the Prophet Muhammad do if he was in such a place.
Barber says some people follow local time and others follow Mecca. It depends on what feels right to each person. He says the timing isn't as important as the fast itself, which helps people become more conscientious of God. And when people fast together as a community during Ramadan, which is also a season of blessing and forgiveness, they're supported through the struggle. This is Aisha Jackson's first fast. She just converted to Islam 4 months ago.
It's going good. I'm very, very happy. I feel great. So it's going. Alhamdulillah. Let's just say it was hard at first, but now I'm okay.
This year, Jackson decided to fast by Mecca time, but she doesn't think she will in the future.
I just feel that this is good. This is good. But I think Allah puts you where you're supposed to be, and you should be going with what you're supposed to be. He knows where you are, so he doesn't make anything too hard for you. So I think, you know, inshallah, you know, I'll do Alaska or local time.
For Jackson, her biggest challenge isn't the fast. It's working up the courage to wear her hijab or headscarf in public.
Yeah, with everything that's in the world, you know, and what's going on, and as for a woman, you know, you don't know who, what, when, you know, so it's a little nervous. It makes me a little fearful, but, you know, inshallah, God will make it right.
Najjar expresses similar concerns. She doesn't wear her hijab to work because people look at her differently, and she's scared that she could be fired. Her friends have similar fears and have been harassed for covering their hair. She says she already hears many negative comments about Islam and violence, especially in the wake of the Orlando attack, though Islam does not condone violence, especially against innocent people.
Always Muslim, 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 Muslim bad, Muslim bad, Muslim. What can I do? I sometimes quiet. I get hurt feeling to say about the Islam.
Another family, who follows local time for the fast, decided not to be part of this story because they also feared community backlash against Muslims. Despite these feelings of unease in public, Najjar still comes to the masjid every night to break the fast and pray with others.
I will be so sad when Ramadan over, because this is the month that God forgiveness. This is the month that God will give you more hasana, more good blessing to the person.
For Najjar and others, it's a time for community and connection, when a long summertime fast isn't a burden, but a blessing. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
A fast-moving storm is set to hit a wide swath of south-central Alaska starting this evening. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, it's expected to start in the Copper River Basin and spread through the Matanuska-Susitna Valley, Anchorage, and the northern Kenai Peninsula.
Andy Dixon is a hydrologist for the National Weather Service. He says the western Copper River Basin and parts of the Susitna Valley will be hit the hardest.
Basically, Glen Allen over to Sutton, Eureka, Chicoloon, that area, will see the heaviest rainfall. The people driving along the Denali Highway are going to, any streams that you're passing by, you're going to notice that the water levels are going up quite a bit.
Dixon says an inch and a half of rain could fall in those areas. In the Anchorage area, he says between half an inch to an inch are in the forecast. Further south, along the northern Kenai Peninsula, a half inch or less is expected. The storm will first hit the Copper River Basin this evening. Then Dixon says it will spread into the Susitna Valley, Anchorage, and the northern Kenai Peninsula.
And then the whole thing, just like it starts from east and moves to the west, it's also going to end first in the east. And so that's probably going to happen tomorrow morning. And I would say by midday to early afternoon tomorrow, probably the Anchorage area will see the steady rainfall come to an end.
The main concern for residents in the affected areas, Dixon says, is water pooling on the roadways and a significant rise in water levels.
We're not expecting any flooding at this time, but it is going to be, we do want to get the word out to people that if you have property or interests in or along the river, definitely be prepared for the water to come up in a fairly rapid fashion, not in a flash flood type fashion, but in a pretty quick fashion associated with heavy rain.
Dixon says water levels in Anchorage and the Matsu are currently on the lower end and expected to rise, and portions of the Kenai River, which is running high, might also see a slight uptick. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, Josh Edge, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Mitchell Borden in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.